So, let's look at where we are with respect to the handout now. So what you have in quotation three on the handout is what he says right after the thought experiment in the fountain pen that we looked at last time. In the thought experiment in the fountain pen, we had the thought experiment of three different kinds of people being presented with a certain experience. Professor Clarence experience of a fountain pen. Child experience of a smooth biteable, excuse me for a moment. The savage from the beginning presented with a peculiar, possibly man-made, possibly divine artifact. Unlike Schlick, Lewis thinks there's no way to strip away the concepts and just get at the given itself. The fountain-like, cat-pen-like character, or Schlick talks about that balloon character, whatever. No, our experience of it goes through our concepts. The savage's concept goes through his concepts. Even a little baby, if he can think at all, has his own, as Lewis calls them in one place, proto-concepts. So you can't strip them away. So he's not trying to get you face-to-face with bare qualia. He doesn't think you can do that. But what he's trying to show you is that there must be qualia. And what the qualia are not that they have exactly the same sensuous experience. He realizes that can't be right either. Both for empirical reasons and because it wouldn't help. Because it was just something particular. It wouldn't be able to play this guy anymore. But that there must be something qualitatively the same at the level of the character of sense experience across these three experiences that grounds the concepts. Our concepts themselves wouldn't give us knowledge of something outside the concepts themselves. It wouldn't give us a vulnerable picture of the world, to borrow that metaphor. So, he says, what he's trying to get here is the character of the thing as a merely presented colligation of sense qualities. That's what I was trying to work on. That's an attempt to gloss what he's trying to show us that there must be. He's not trying to introspectively get you to isolate this apart from the concepts. We saw last, he thinks you can't do that. Experience is always thick. That's one of the many things the empiricist is wrong about. So the argument is a much weaker one. He's trying to keep the grain and truth in empiricism while rendering it immune from all of the attacks from the idealists. He's trying to say that the grain of truth is that there must be something qualitatively the same at the level of sense that grounds these differences, even though each of them from within will have an experience that's structured by their concepts, and that's all they can have. But if we want to say their concepts are right, and we even want to say things like, when the native says, uses his word for artifact, he can't experience it as a fountain pen, he says, but artifact, well, he's not wrong. Any more than I'm wrong in saying this is a chair, and Michael says this is a stool. We don't decide which of us is right. Even if we start counting in a room which has complicated furniture, we might get different answers because the concepts have different extensions. So that's just the first line of that quotation. You had a question.
Yeah, it's moving off. In my view, that's sort of a problem hidden here because three examples, Lewis is used with the sandwich and you and another person. And you also mentioned a child. And my question is, a child may have proto-concepts if they have like a sparse repertoire of concepts, but what about infants? And the next question, what about animals? Take a monkey, for example. What would Lewis say to that? Because that's a big discussion now, like discussing.
Definitely. There's a number of issues here. First of all, one of the things I'm going to try to show you by the end of today is that there's a big problem here. So I agree. First, I'm trying to make Lewis seem sympathetic. You can see where there's a problem. But I also want you to see there's a problem, because that's when you have Kantian skepticism, when there's a problem, not just the solution. So I'm trying to bring out the problem. But I will just answer you. So that's the main thing I want to say in answer to your question, is there is a problem, and we're going there. But just to say a couple of short things. Now, I don't think Lewis is very satisfying about animals. Lewis is, in this respect, he thinks they don't really have concepts. And so he thinks they don't really have experience. So you have a story about how it is they're guided by the world. But he really does want to see that as a story in which the constraint is causal. They don't have thoughts that are correct and incorrect. That's what he'll say about animals. Now, that makes it a very big gulf. I also think some of the things he says about children are quite problematic by his own lights. It's hard, and there, if you want to be a certain kind of Kantian, the way Lewis says, children are hard to think about. Because you can't have one concept on Lewis's view, and you can't have two concepts. You can't have three concepts. You need all of the color concepts. You need the concept that they are colors. And if you start thinking about it, you need to be able to distinguish something's being a color from something else in order to have the concept of a color. And so it's looking like you don't have any concepts, you need a lot of concepts. And so how light dawns gradually over the whole for the child becomes a real problem for someone like Lewis, what the way in could look like. And he definitely, and what some of the things he says about children make it very hard to see what a proto-concept would be. It's hard to see how you have a half of a concept. it's a little bit like being almost pregnant. It doesn't look like there's a way to be just almost there. It looks like it's in or out.
I was also asking because the term proto-concept is also used by Putnam.
Oh, yeah. And these problems that Lewis is in are all over contemporary. Part of the interest of Lewis is he is, I think, one of the people that really thought through the shape of the problems so that the agenda we have now is coming into view here. And I think that's part of why it's interesting, to see how what it looks like when it comes into view in its relatively, as it were, unnaive, unprofessionalized, uncomplicated, speciated, colonized form. So that's part, but one of the things I'm going to say at the end of today is you can see lots of contemporary issues springing out of this. That's absolutely right. That's part of my point of looking at Lewis before we look at Putnam and McDowell. Exactly right. But I do think that, you know, it is right that if you have something like Lewis's view of concepts, then concepts are going to go the way, as the American expression says, of horseshoes and hand grenades. You know, it looks like, you know, almost isn't going to do you a lot of good. You have to, either it's a hit or it isn't. There isn't some way to just almost be there. You can't have the pin almost out of the hand grenade. So it's almost exploding. You know, I didn't kill him, but I didn't just miss him either. I almost. That's just nothing. Till the pin's out, it's nothing. And until you got a concept, it looks like in Lewis's view, you've got nothing. And so children are hard to think about that. Because you need that, because it turns out to have a concept, you need the conceptual. So animals are out of the game, and it's not clear how children go from being animals to something else. All true, all for later. But that, I think, is really that developmental problem, though. I actually think this is a big claim, you don't have to believe this, but I actually think that's just really a species of the problem we have here in synchronic rather than diachronic form. Just like the problem about the intention, how can the intention be the cause? And we've got things temporally distinct, and we haven't put ourselves a causal story. Just makes vivid a feature of a problem of the story we already have in synchronic form in the other versions of Cartesian skepticism. So I think it's absolutely right that that problem is relevant here. I don't think it's structurally different, which is, you know, if the concepts just come for free, how could anything that happened before take you into the concepts in a way that would be interesting? That's just sort of, as it were, something that's sort of happening in a moment here is being slowed down as a process of development. I don't think it's a different problem. I think you're quite right, I think it's a related problem. And if Lewis has a problem here, he's going to have a problem there. What I think is right about Lewis is he really sees this problem, and he sort of sweeps that problem under the rug. But I think you're right that, you know, he should be just as worried about the one as the other. That I think is true too. Okay. So now, just a little bit about quail. So what Lewis wants to say then is there has to be a quality of sense that is the basis of the application of concepts. It's going to be the basis, the application of the concepts. One of the things he sees is that the aspect of sense we're talking about has to have some generality. It has to be, when I see this, and I see this, and I see this, I see all of those things as relevantly like each other in such a way that all of them merit the application of the concept green. We're only going to have guidance if we have some structure of generality that we're latching onto to experience. So what he wants to do is grant all of the idealist claims about the conceptual and how it has to be spontaneous and so forth. We have to bring it. It involves arbitrary boundaries and so forth between concepts. And then say, but there's another kind of generality. So there's being the instance of a concept. That's the thing we understand well in philosophy. And then there's being the instance of a quail. The problem with the traditional empiricist notion of impression, Lewis will now say, is it confuses these two. Locke will say, we have an impression of a triangle. We can't have an anything of a triangle unless we have the concept of a triangle. That's not an impression. But there's got to be something which we can talk of as in an impression of way. One of the things that Lewis will say, and Sellars will be even clearer about this later, is that even this of functions differently. The kind of relation this is, the kind of nexus of instance caught up in some more general thing itself determines the meaning of the of. So this of is itself something we need to understand. But so there's something which is being an instance of a quail. The level of sense experience, if we drop, and if the savage looks away and looks back again, if I look away and I look back again, we can both recognize that as the same again, which leads us to put, or if it disappears and then we find it again. A wind blows, and we have to run after it and find it, and we see it as the same again. There is that which is the qualitatively the same in both our experiences. The savage sees it's the same again, uses the same concepts, uses it of something. So a recognitional capacity, but this recognitional capacity has to be, he thinks, prior to concepts. So this is all Lewis working really hard to import some substance to this notion of guidance. Because he's afraid, unless we give some substance to this notion of guidance, unless we can make out this arrow in this direction, not just this arrow in this direction, but this arrow in this direction, to have some normative character and not a merely causal character, we are going to be left with the problem of quotation two. So, say, we'll go a little further, but let's just stop for a moment and say Lewis fails. Lewis is trying hard to tell a story like this. But say you were to say to Lewis, you fail, and what's more, you must fail. There's no way to tell this story. What would that mean to Lewis? That would mean something like, you're telling me that we have these concepts, and there's nothing that guides them? Or you're telling me stuff just comes in and causally impinges, and that magically? You either have a story in which there's no empirical content, you have the problem of quotation two, or you have the problem of traditional empiricism, where you incoherently and magically help yourself to things that have the shape of ideas. There's something like written into the character of experience themselves. So what you have there then, if there's no way to tell the story, is what I was calling a Kantian boggle. It looks like the very experience we're trying to explicate is something that there's no way to make sense of the possibility of happening. That's what would happen if you couldn't tell us. So, from Lewis's point of view, there's got to be a way to tell a story. And Lewis is trying, this is part of why I think it's interesting, he's trying to be as careful and minimal about this as he can. So, he's saying, there's got to be constraint. All I mean by the given So let's look at quotations four and five. I'm going to get a little ahead of myself. So quotations four, we have him introducing the idea of the quail. Now he's being a little unstrict here, I should point out. He corrects himself later. He says, this content of a specific quail, such as the immediacy of redness or loudness. But a couple of you, I know from our discussion, will say, loudness and redness are contents. Those can't be descriptions of the content of the quail. And he says that later on, as you'll see. So it's a kind of loose way of talking, which then has to be taken back. The fact that you say things that you have to take back is very much a sign that you're in a Kantian problematic. The very describing of the problematic involves saying things and then saying, well, actually, I didn't quite mean it that way. Kripke has this problem. You know, the Churchlands have this problem. Rorty has this problem. Brandom has this problem. Philosophers who are working the Kantian problematic, they tell you what their issue is, and they say, well, that looked like it. But actually, we weren't literally talking about commitment at that point, because commitment involves these things. We're talking about another kind of normative constraint that's less than full commitment, that grounds it. So you have something you seem to be talking about, you find, well, you weren't actually talking about that, but that was a way in. And then later on, we see why it wasn't that. What would it have been like to just start out saying something that you didn't have to take back? Very unclear. Is that a problem? Maybe not. The presentation of event is unique. The qualia that make it up or not, they are recognizable from one experience to the next. Such specific qualia and repeatable complexes of them, I think he's thinking of certain phenomenologists here, certain American followers of Husserl, are sometimes called essences. This term with such a meaning will here be avoided. The liability to confuse such qualia with universal concepts makes this imperative. We can't take this universality to be anything like the universality of concepts. Or we want to have respect to the point of quotation one. We need to get it close enough so there can be a constraint, but far enough so that neither limits the other. So we have independent external constraint. We need constraints, so it can't be too far. We need external constraints, so it can't be too close. And the question is, once you start working this picture, can you do that? Once you start getting close enough for constraint, a worry is going to be, but this kind of constraint is collapsing into that kind of constraint. You start trying to tell the story, so you pull this far enough, parts of these are really independent. It stops looking like this normatively bears on that. That's not very quick description of a kind of dilemma that Lewis is in, that he's trying really hard to avoid. What any concept denotes, or any adjective such as red or round, is something more complex than the identifiable sense quail, quotation five. So there he's already admitting that any description of this is not just description of the qualia, but of something more. We always see them back through the light of our concepts. And he gives a number of reasons why this is true. A first reason is that qualia themselves don't have time span, they're always in a minute. More important, they're repeatable in experience and intrinsically recognizable. They can have no names. Anything that has a name is articulable and recognizable at a level that involves concepts. So he's realizing not just they're not concepts, but the particulars we can talk about, we can only talk about because they fall under concepts. A further deep Kantian point. You didn't know things like Richard was a person, Fido was a dog. You wouldn't be able to keep track of Fido as that particular. The sense in which we can isolate the given is only in an abstract sense. It says in quotation, it's only available through a certain kind of philosophical reflective activity of abstraction. Quotation 8. We can thus isolate the element of the given by these criteria of its unalterability and its character as sensuous feel or quality. We cannot describe any particular given as such. Since we get into description, we always have more than the merely given. Because in describing whatever fashion, we qualify it by bringing it into some category or other. Any concept is going to have some conceptual shape or form or category. That's very annoying. Did I say something wrong? I won't do it again. So he says, in a sense, the given is ineffable, always. It's that which remains untouched and unaltered, however it is construed by thought. This is his attempt, as I put it, to try to be very minimal. He's trying to say, look, there's got to be something that we don't control. We, in a sense, author our concepts. We could change the shape of our concepts. We could realign our cover vocabulary if we wanted to. Scientists do constantly realign their vocabulary for how to talk about the most basic things. In the history of civilization, languages have done this. But there's got to be something, an experience, which we don't control, which anchors the use of the concepts. Or there wouldn't be any sense to be made of the idea that our perceptual experience of the world is right or wrong, right or wrong. So, he says, that's the given. It's given to us. We cannot deny that. He thinks that's a minimal claim. And he thinks it's also a minimal claim that this must in some way guide. If it just causally impinged, that would be nothing. It can't causally impinge and for free give us impressions of triangles without already having the concepts of it. So the concepts come from there, that this must somehow guide them. That, he thinks, so far is also not the claim of the thing. He's trying to be very careful. And he said, but how does this guidance go? We wouldn't have guidance unless we had some kind of generality in the structure of the universe. That's the claim nothing, he thinks. This is vocabulary for just making that assumption explicit. So Lewis thinks he's taking baby steps here. There's more philosophy to do. But he's just taking baby steps. You can't really deny any of this. Or what? Or the lights would go out. That's my way of putting Lacantian skepticism. We wouldn't have any experience. We wouldn't even have false experiences. Kant says, we did not have this much unity. Things that were structured this way, they can be of things, such that they have objective validity, they have purport. We did not have that much. Kant says we would have less than a dream. That's Lewis's point. And he's trying to say, what are the conditions of less than a dream? And he thinks he's, as I also said, following Kant. That's a further claim. Yes, Dixon. Yes.
I'm still thinking about this idea of guidance.
Yes.
What happens in this case, for example, we have a concept we get from the given. Let's give an example of maybe a species that gets extinct will remain the concept when the species is no more. And secondly,
well, that's no problem at all. I mean, that's a Cartesian. You might say that's a Cartesian problem. How do we know certain things exist? The issue here is how can you have? We have the concept of a unicorn.
Let me first finish the other side.
Okay, sorry.
Then the other side is the given that come from the concept. For example, we, out of scientific imagination, we developed the idea maybe of a dinosaur or something.
Yes.
And we've created it. It's come from a concept and it's coming a given. Mm-hmm. And concepts, maybe secondary concepts, they originate from it. So I don't know whether this relation still exists.
This is a more fundamental question. I mean, you're really back in a Cartesian question. Horses exist. I think that's true. You can show your horse. Unicorns exist. I think that's false. But we can look into it. Unicorns are the horses that are supposed to have the horns. But both these questions take for granted that the thought horses exist have a bearing in the world. We know how to sort, we can, as it were, when we say that's a horse, there is, or that's not a horse, there's some way the world is that can bear on what we're thinking. That a Cartesian's wonder, when we have such thoughts, are they true or false? Lewis's question ultimately is, how can we so much as think either of these thoughts? The thought that horses exist as a false thought. Say we believe. What are we doing when we even do that? We're still assuming that there's some way that when we apply the concept unicorn, there is a rightness and wrong to it. It bears on something outside of experience. So it's got to be, when you see a horse and you say horse, there's got to be something about what you see and what you think that connect them. How can there so much as be a connection, even a bad connection? That's the question. So That's what, one of the reasons I'm doing this is because I think this kind of Kantian problem is harder to understand. It's much the kind of Cartesian question where one says, well, this is true, but now how do we know that? How do we really know that this is true? That's the easier philosophical question. And what I'm trying to do today, maybe not successfully, is bring out a completely different kind of problem, this time within perception, which doesn't have the structure, which makes all of this, as I put it when we're having the features, equally problematic. The very fact that you choose an example like dinosaurs or unicorns, that's a good case. You know, we had this stuff about examples and choosing your examples for Cartesian skepticism. That's a good case for Cartesian skepticism. It makes an issue of existence. Does it really exist? Pressing. If you have a Kantian problematic, it doesn't matter what your example is. You don't have to go to the unicorns and the dinosaurs. The cell phones, the hats, colors, anything, any concept. We lose all our concepts at once if we can't make sense of this relation of guidance. We lose every concept. We lose the concept of the concept. we make sense that we understand what we're saying when we ask the question, are there any concepts? That's what I mean by saying, the lights go out. If this doesn't make sense, we're not even capable of dreaming. We can't even get that much unity going in our perceptual experience. So the worry, and there's a sense in which you can't imagine that's how things are. There isn't anything which is imagining that. It's sort of like trying to imagine your death. There isn't anything to imagine. I mean, there is no you left if the Kantian skeptical problematic. You're not still in the picture, just having no thoughts. Part of who you are is a possible subject of experiences and thoughts. You go as a self along with everything else. But the problem is, if you have Lewis's problem, is it's hard to see how there can be something that has, in this case, if we're talking about philosophy of perception, the character the perceptual experience does, if it's language, the semantic character language has, and so forth for the various meaning. This is why it's very intuitive. The point of Kantian skepticism isn't you imagine what it would be like if the Kantian skeptic is right. You can't do that. That's why I say it's not a doubt. The character, if you're wrong, isn't one of disappointment. Gee, I can imagine it. That would be great, but we can't have it. Okay. It's not like that. But still, if you start with the kind of considerations Lewis is starting with, and they seem minimal, and you get into trouble, then you do boggle. A philosophical bind of a certain part sort of comes in. But it's one about how we can have concepts, all of them at once.
I just want to remark, to me it seems that this realistic rest of the given is working quite the same, or is the same, like what in Kant's philosophy is the Ding an sich. How do you answer this question?
Well, I think the one problem with that is, I think it's, I with respect to the issue of the relationship between sensibility and understanding last cast, I showed you four different readings of Kant. Four different ways of saying, these are both independent of each other, neither is sufficient, both are necessary. There's at least as many readings of the Ding an sich. I think most readings of the Ding an sich, if you look at secondary literature, are actually quite wrong because they're Cartesian. As most people think, the Ding an sich is something like an object that impinges on us, and then we have an experience, and we call the experience the phenomenon. And then how do we know behind the phenomenon there really is that Ding an sich? And then Kant's often read as saying, we can't say anything about it. And that's a Cartesian problematic, I think. And moreover, it's to make Kant out to be a Cartesian skeptic, I think. So I think it's a bad read of Kant, but it's the most common. But once you get rid of that and you put Kant in a Kantian problematic, as these people all were for sensible understanding, that doesn't tell you how to read the relationship between das Ding an sich and an Erscheinung. There's as many readings of that as there are about this issue. Those things go together. Kant says, you know, in the preface to the B edition, you know, that an appearance is a concept that doesn't make a sense unless there's something that appears. So, the things in themselves as appearances are those same things talked about in two ways. So, he suggests that Ding an sich isn't another thing that's behind the appearance. The thing on sich is that which appears. So I think most people, at least in the Kantian problematic, will have that much straight. But then there's still a question about how you do that, how you tell that story. There's several versions of that. We could talk about it, but it would take us astray. But I think Lewis, does Ding on Zishin Khan, I think if you're reading carefully, is as actually one problem is it can mean more than one thing. The expression, I think, has a univocal reference in Khan. Sorry, has a univocal sense in Khan, but not a univocal reference. It's a comparative thing. There's a thing in itself, the thing in relation to other things. That's a comparative term, like bigger than. And so it doesn't have a single reference. It has a single sense. Then there's the thing in itself versus the thing in its relation to a cognizing subject. That's a more specific relation. And then I think in Kant's philosophy, that's speciated in many ways. Sometimes the rain is the thing in itself. The rainbow is the appearance. That's one way of using the vocabulary in one context. The important way of using it in the context of the theoretical philosophy, in the context of the first half of the critique and the analytic, those are two important qualifications, is as what he calls the negative concept of the noumenon. The negative concept of the noumenon is we consider the object of knowledge and abstract out from it any cognitive contribution we make, sensible or intellectual. That's the negative concept of the noumenon. What can we say about it at that point? Kant says, nothing. I don't think he says we can't know anything about it. He's very clear about this, actually, in the second edition. To say we can't know anything about it would be to talk about it as a kind of object. He says a great mistake is people act as if the negative concept of the object were a determinate kind of funny object about which we cannot know anything, rather than realizing that what we have is an indeterminate concept of an object, thus one that cannot support the concept of knowledge. But the point is the negative concept of the noumenon, which is probably the most important, but only one of 20 things he means by this thing on Zish, is something from which we have abstracted all our cognitive contributions. That's not what Lewis means by the given. The given involves sensibility. We're abstracting out the intellectual contribution, but not the sensible contribution. That is a topic that Kant talks about in the critique, as Lewis knows, but not under the label of das Ding an sich. Because it's not das Ding an sich, it's das Ding als sinnliche Erscheinung. That's what we're talking about here. the abstraction only involves the concepts, but it's not abstracting from our cognitive powers altogether. What we're interested in is what sensibility contributes on its own. Not what the thing contributes on its own. But he thinks unless sensibility made a contribution on its own, the thing would not constrain our concepts. So we are interested in the relationship between the concepts and the things. But the given is not a name for the things. It's a name for a certain aspect of how things appear sensible.
Yeah, but just one answer to that. It seems that what you're speaking about, the given, you know, it's not reachable. We can never subtract our
Lewis concept. Totally agrees. He's absolutely clear. Lewis totally agrees. He's absolutely clear. Exactly. He's absolutely clear about that point. He's absolutely clear about that. It's not a criticism of Lewis.
Yeah.
Lewis's argument is you can't ever get at the given itself. That's why we need this constipated experiment of the thought experiment of the pen, where we have three cases and we say, there must be something in common. We can't get at it. We can only get at found time. That's why it's so complicated for him. That's why it's not like Christ. When his argument is, there must be a given. We can see this reflectively. This is, you know, as you might put it, a transcendental positive.
Yeah, it's just a postulation.
Right. That's that, right. No, it's not just the postulation.
It seems like.
It must be, else we would not have. That's the tone here. Postulation is there might be, now let's do experiments or something. Here it's there must be, or you couldn't do experiments. it's a posit in some sense, but it is gazettes, as Fichte will say. Not an accident that his dissertation's on Fichte, but that's not to say it's a mere posit. That would be to suggest that there's some other way at this. Let's get at the problems here. We got 7 minutes, and I have spent all of my time making Lewis plausible and powerful, but I want you to also worry about him. I want you to see, this is someone who is thinking hard. It's not that he doesn't see the problems. If things don't work where they don't work here, there's trouble. There's big trouble. All of the philosophy is happening today. I think I can draw a map with respect to this problem and place Davidson, McDowell, Brandom, Sellars, and lots of other philosophers, Evans, within the space of trouble that is here. They're all philosophers arguing about how to get out of the problem, if there's a problem. Some people saying, you have to tell this story of guidance differently. Other people saying, you have to tell this story of guidance differently, essentially what Sellars and Evans in their very different ways do. Other philosophers saying, as long as you have guidance of this sort, you'll always have a version of the myth of the given. That's what Brandom and Davidson both say. But then people say to them, but then you have just the problem. But Sellars says you have, that Lewis says you have a quotation too. You have a kind of coherentism, which grounds nothing. Then you have McDowell say, well, the boundary of the conceptual can't have an outside. It is not bounded. And then people look at McDowell and say, we don't know what that means. And so all of us philosophers are arguing about a problem that takes its root here. Now, let's see sort of locally how the problem... Well, one thing I just wanted to bring up, quotation 11 on the handout, reply from Freud. I just wanted to... I don't have time to read those now. It turns out I was going to. But what you'll see if you read this, I just think it's good to have the mood of this. I have chosen, maybe I'll just read you one sentence from the reply to Freud. I have chosen this name, the given, as having minimal implications of anything beyond the character of it as data and immediate. If you don't like the word given, choose some other name. But let us not abdicate to those who think that if we can be prevented from using any word which applies to immediate experience or any factor, we may immediately forget there is such a thing. Backing up. Four lines down on 665. Anyone who wished to say about thee did not understand what was so denoted by this term, the given, would have been regarded as a candidate for the booby hatch. I quoted that last time. This is just, they're trying to make it graphic how Lewis thinks if you deny the bit he wants here, you're saying something that makes no sense. You're saying our concepts aren't in any way grounded in what their concepts are. He's trying to tell a minimal story of grounding your guidance. He knows this isn't very philosophical, satisfying. There has to be more work. He's just trying to take the baby steps. You can't deny any of these baby steps. But the problem is, immediately, in philosophy, the next generation, as philosophy students often do to their teachers, turn on him and do say the baby steps were too big. Took too many steps, Clarence. The first step was too big a step. But the way they really, but the place the pressure really comes is right here. So a famous locus of criticism here, historically in the 50s, which then got lost in the popularization of it. The reason it got lost is people didn't want the problem, I think, to come as clearly into view again later, was in something like, two-thirds of the way through. And only once you get two-thirds of the way through, Sellars empiricism and the philosophy of life. Sellars tries to make explicit what the assumption here is by saying, what you have to assume, and he points out the empiricists, the more subtle empiricists, Locke, Berkeley and Locke already had an assumption like this. What you have to assume is what he calls repeatable sense determinables. There has to be some way to say, this is a case, there has to be some way where you can experience something as a case of this quail. A case of this quail. Something that has a structure of a determinable. Like, cat. Cat is a determinable. If I ask you, what color is cat? There's no answer to that. Any particular cat is a particular color. The cat is a determinable. It's a concept. It's not itself fully determinate. It is further determined. Any instance of it is fully determined. It's part of what Kant means by saying concepts are general and immediate. And what we want is something that is in sense itself, that has the structure of a determinable. We want to be able to say, here's this thing in sense that can be further determined, but it's just there in sense, having this character of a determinable. And it's repeatable. I can recognize it as the same determinable again. And what Sellers is going to argue is, bracket this word, you can't, there isn't anything which has the structure of a repeatable determinable that isn't itself already a concept. This is the structure that comes with full-blown thought. We're abstracting a feature of judgment out when we judge that X is phi. We want something to have the determinable character of a phi. And we're projecting that then onto a feature of our capacities. It's supposed to be prior to and independent of our capacity for thought. We're projecting a shadow of a conceptual structure onto something which is itself supposed to be inherently non-conceptual. And so this sets up a problem in philosophy, which is, can there be a kind of content that guides conceptual content, which is non-conceptual, but isn't itself, when we tell the story about what non-conceptual content is, just a way of projecting the shadow of concepts back a level while pretending we've got something that's independent. And that's a debate that's raging right now. But, and you know, there's two sides to it, and people keep telling stories, and people keep saying, no, in a more subtle way, you've imported a feature of conception into your story of mere sensation. And the other people saying, no, 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 that's the kind of informational content that we can get into this description, which later on, and so forth. But the whole structure of this debate comes from trying to find something that can do this work that's immune to this criticism. Oh, is it really that time?
Well, I'll take 2 minutes.
I'll draw one more little picture in the work. I think it might help bring out the problem. Might help to interpolate some levels here. So this is just perception. A case of Kantian skepticism, but my claim is you see this structure throughout Kantian skepticism. So again, this is a picture. When I draw pictures, Cartesian pictures coming, I'm asking you to trust them. I'm just trying to map a philosophical shape. If we really focus on the picture and you become suspicious of it, all the better, as I'm concerned. But on this picture, we have something like the objects over here. Then we have sense. We have some layer of sense. And sense looks like it's an unacquired capacity. It's something we just have. And then over here, we have experiences. Perceptual experiences. And then we have beliefs based on those perceptual experiences. They're sometimes called non-inferential beliefs. We just have them in the virtue of having experiences. I get a telegram, I conclude my mother's in New York. I infer that based on what I see. I look, I see Richard. When I conclude that Richard's here, it's just because I see it. That's not an inference. That belief is just based on the perceptual experience. And then we have our more complicated inferential beliefs. My belief that there are philosophy students, that there are at least 20 philosophy students in Bergen, is an inference based on many individual perceptions. It involved my actually seeing 20, well, I guess I better make that number larger, 40 philosophy students at one time. So we have the objects. They cause us to sense things. That causes us, and we must still say cause, us to have a perceptual experience. That gives rise to an inferential belief. That gives rise to a non-inferential belief. That gives rise to an inferential belief. How should we understand these arrows? Lewis is saying, this has to be a causal arrow. And that alone can't give you any constraint. The empiricists act as if you could just make this arrow go straight to here and somehow you have these non-inferential beliefs, that there's a triangle in front of you. That's not going to work. This belief here, from your perceptual experience to your belief that there is something, that's a conceptually structured justification. That's a this is a reason for believing that. It's one way of calling it, saying what this kind of arrow is. Why do you think riches is real? Because I can see him. That's my reason. And Lewis says, if we're not going to get into trouble here, we need some other way to say what this arrow is. There's an arrow here that's got to ground this. Can't merely be a cause, but can't be a reason. This has the grammar, if you will, the logic of mere efficient causation. This has the grammar or the logic, if you will, of rationalization, things being reasons for each other, logically structured space. This has to be another kind of space. It has to have, if you will, a sui generis logical grammar. That's a very generic way to put what Lewis thought. Then Lewis tries to tell a story about that in terms of Quellia. That story collapses, later people thought. If there's nothing here, we got a big problem. This is Kantian skepticism. If we can't get the top of the board and the bottom of the board together. So the question is, how do you fill this in? Or do you redraw the picture? A lot of philosophers are trying to fill this in. You know, non-conceptual content itself is just or informational content, is just a fancy name for a way of trying to tell a story, which is arrow can do work. Different details of Lewis. But to that extent, they share his picture. Other people, what Grandham and Davidson trying to do is tell a story in which they say, any version of this, Rorty's a case of this too, in much detail, this arrow is always just a hopeless amalgamation of these two arrows. So they try to say, no, we really, you know, we're sensations, they're not very interesting. But then the things just also stand in causal relations to our perceptual beliefs. And that's okay, and justification all happens within here. And a lot of people think, no, very problem Lewis said in quotation two. This is an empty story about concepts. Empty in the Kantian sense of empty. Coherentism in the names of the critics that are saying it's mere coherence. And mere coherence isn't going to be a picture of the world. That's one kind of solution. So, another kind of, McDowell's answer is essentially to say, there's something wrong with the whole picture. But the point is to say, the debates take their point of departure from a problem like this. But as long as we can't tell a coherent story about how there could be a bearing of thought on the world, what kind of constraint on the world and what we think, what looms in philosophy of perception is a problem. It's not a Cartesian problem anymore. It's a problem of our not being able to make sense of the very possibility of experience. That's Kantian skepticism, philosophy of perception. See you on Monday.